Today, losses ahead, market stress into uncertainty as policy arena shifts. Hello again, this is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and property news. This is our weekly market update where we start in the US, cross to Europe and Asia, and end in Australia, covering crypto and commodities along the way. And this past week, well, it's been very busy, so this will be a mega long post. As expected, markets continue to wrestle with mega levels of uncertainty, largely driven by US President Trump, as investors are grappling with dramatic policy changes across the world. Trump's back-to-back implementation of fresh tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China exacerbated broad concerns about the economy. In another U-turn, Trump decided to exempt products covered by the 2018 United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the so-called USMCA, from the recent imposition of 25% tariffs until April the 2nd. The new US administration's highly uncertain tariff policy looks to be damaging confidence and impacting activity, said analysts at ING in a note. Under the new Trump administration, the barrage of initiatives on trade and other issues, such as federal workforce cuts, has fed uncertainty for businesses and consumers. Market unease is also rising. The volatility index jumped this week and was around its highest level since late last year, up 41% compared with the start of the year. Volatility is here to stay for a while because we do not have economic and trade policy certainty, said Irene Tunkel, chief US equity strategist at BCA Research. Markets were also shaken by Germany's surprise spending plans, which drove a sell-off in the benchmark German bond. The German 10-year rose by 90% over the past week to 2.835. Beyond that, deep questions about the future of NATO and Ukraine have forced European nations to reset their defence spending. Stocks swung wildly on Friday, with the S&P 500 little changed in afternoon trade. Major indices cut losses, actually, following midday comments from Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, who told an economic forum that the economy continues to be in a good place. Despite that, the benchmark S&P 500 marked its worst week in 6 months. It was down more than 4% from a month ago. The tech-heavy NASDAQ composite on Thursday ended down by more than 10% from its December all-time closing high, confirming that it's been in a correction for several months. The Dow was also off from highs last year, down more than 3%. The global MSCI index rose 0.2% on Friday and was down 1.26% across the week, and saw a decline of 5% since its record high on February the 18th. In contrast, the European Stoxx 600 was down 0.46% on Friday and 0.69% from Monday, but is still up 9% year-to-date. But then, the Australian ASX 200 fell 1.81% on Friday and was down 2.74% across the week and down more than 6% over the past month. Recent US economic data has disappointed, so one silver lining for stocks has been that markets are now factoring in more interest rate cuts by the Federal Reserve this year to account for potential growth weakening. Data on Friday showed US job growth picked up in February, according to the Labor Department. Non-farm payrolls increased by 151,000 jobs last month after rising by a downwardly revised 125,000 in January, but cracks are emerging in the once resilient labor market amid the chaotic trade policy and federal government spending cuts. The unemployment rate edged up to 4.1%. The number of Americans holding multiple jobs climbed to a record high of nearly 8.9 million. Multiple job holders as share of total employment is the highest since 2009, just before the GFC. The participation rate, the share of the population that's working or looking for work, fell to the lowest level in 2 years, largely among men, according to Friday's report. The rate of workers aged 25 to 54, also known as prime age workers, held steady at 83.5%, and the report showed that average hourly earnings increased 0.3% from January after an upwardly revised 0.4% gain. Atlanta Federal Reserve President Raphael Bostic said on Thursday that Trump's policies were clouding the US economic outlook and also warned that his tariffs could underpin inflation. But Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell acknowledged increased uncertainty in the US economic outlook, but said officials don't need to rush to adjust policy. Despite elevated levels of uncertainty, the US economy continues to be in a good place, Powell said at an event on Friday in New York, hosted by the University of Chicago Booth Business School. We do not need to be in a hurry, and are well positioned to wait for greater clarity. Powell noted lingering unknowns about the potential effects of President Donald Trump's economic plans, including for trade and immigration, while there have been recent developments in some areas, especially trade policy, uncertainty around the changes and their likely effects remain high, he said. The cost of being cautious is very, very low, he said. The economy is fine. It doesn't need us to do anything, really, and we can wait, and we should wait. And he added that the cost of inaction might rise if inflation expectations were clearly under pressure. Carlson Group, the macroeconomic research firm, reaffirmed its 75% probability of a US recession beginning in the near term, citing weakening economic conditions and growing downside risks. And BCA highlights several factors contributing to the deteriorating outlook. The job opening rate has returned to pre-pandemic levels. Excess household savings have been depleted, and mortgage rates are still above 6% and apply to a significant proportion of homeowners. Rising delinquency on credit cards, auto loans, and commercial real estate further points to financial stress, while consumer confidence has weakened and layoffs have increased. Treasury yields have edged up, influenced by Germany's release of its debt brake, which sent the bond yields up significantly. The US 10-year yield rose 0.7% on Friday to 4.304, while the 2-year was at 4.002, up 0.76% on the day. Now, a critical inflation report in the coming week could further rattle an increasingly tumultuous US stock market, with investors worried about an economic growth slowdown and President Donald Trump's tariffs. The inflation report will be among the last key pieces of data before the Fed next meets on March the 18th and 19th. While the central bank is expected to hold its benchmark rate steady at 4.25 to 4.5% at that meeting, Fed funds futures indicate about 70 more basis points of easing are expected through to December of this year. Investors are also increasingly concerned about stagflation, slowing growth and rising inflation, that is feared to be a toxic combination for a broad range of assets. The market's focus will also be on Washington as lawmakers wrangle over a spending bill that would avert a partial shutdown of agencies late next week. Bank of America strategist, led by Michael Harnett, said the Magnificent Seven stocks have now become the Lagnificent Seven, as the market cap of the group has fallen by $3 trillion to $15 trillion. Tesla is down 34.96% year-to-date, Nvidia down 16%, Microsoft down more than 6%, and Amazon down more than 9%. Meanwhile, China's Fab Four, Baidu, Alibaba, Tencent, and Xiaomi have doubled in value to $1.6 trillion, with the European equities also catching up. We are seeing big changes in investor flows, with international equities faring better than US markets. Investors have also been looking outside the US. In the week to 5th of March, global fund flows showed a continued investor preference for cash, which saw inflows of $53.1 billion, where equities drew $22.9 billion, bonds $12 billion, and gold $1 billion, according to Bank of America's latest report. European equities saw their largest inflow since February 2022, $4.1 billion, while emerging markets had their biggest inflow in 3 months at $2.4 billion. Tech stocks saw their first inflow in 5 weeks at $2.6 billion. And gold had its largest four-week inflow on record at $9.9 billion, while crypto funds saw the biggest four-week outflow ever at $3.6 billion, and treasuries recorded the biggest outflow in 11 weeks at $1.2 billion. In the note, Harnett highlights a structural shift in global markets, stating that whatever it takes, European rearmament will drive EU and UK fiscal expansion, while in the US, Elon Musk-led Doge Department actions are leading to a new fiscal austerity. The US dollar retreated further on Friday, trading at a four-month low amid worries trade policy uncertainty will hit economic activity in the world's largest economy. The dollar index, which tracks the greenback against the basket of the currencies, traded 0.4% lower to 103.81. That's near its weakest level since late October. Gold futures for April's delivery was down just a little to $2,914 a troy ounce. But we continue to see massive gold transfers to New York, creating supply shortages and delivery delays in London. In fact, in January alone, 151 tons were withdrawn from London vaults. In the last 2 months, even 12.2 million ounces of gold were shipped to COMEX warehouses in the US. That's led to a shortage of physical availability of gold in London, resulting in delivery delays. Waiting times for gold withdrawals from the Bank of England's vaults have extended from a few days to 4 to 8 weeks. This situation was exacerbated by the increasing demand for gold as a safe haven, driven by geopolitical tensions and inflation fears, as well as the buying frenzy in China at the beginning of the Chinese New Year, the year of the snake. At the same time, the long delivery times are arousing mistrust. The main reason cited for the massive relocation of gold stocks from London to New York was primarily the fear of the possibility of new US trade tariffs on precious metals. The audit of gold reserves announced by the Trump administration could also be a possible reason. Additionally, large financial institutions regularly exploit price differences between trading venues to profit from arbitrage transactions. This massive shift has led to a critical supply situation in London. According to the London Bullion Market Association, the available gold stocks at the end of January were around 8,535 tons. Even if the unallocated gold is actually just not in the right size at the right place, the LMNA's statement failed to reassure market participants. Elsewhere in commodity trading, oil prices rose on Friday, but were still set for a hefty weekly decline amid uncertainty around US tariff policy. At the same time, major producers were set to increase output. Markets, including oil, have been whipsawed by fluctuating trade policies in the US, the world's biggest oil consumer. Crude oil for delivery in April rose 1.07% to hit $67.04 a barrel, while the May Brent oil contract rose 1.3% to trade at $70.45 a barrel. For the week, both contracts were off about 3%. European stock markets sank on Friday as investors digested the latest European Central Bank rate reductions ahead of the release of the key US employment data, amid uncertainty over, guess what, US trade policies. The DAX index in Germany dropped 1.75%, the CAC 40 in France slipped 0.94%, and the FTSE in London dipped just a little. Data on Monday showed that consumer prices in the 20 nations sharing the euro eased to 2.4% in February from 2.5% in the prior month, inching closer towards the ECB's stated 2% target. The ECB cut interest rates again this last week. As widely expected, that's the sixth cut since June, but said monetary policy was becoming less restrictive as inflation falls towards its 2% target. The central bank also lowered its growth forecast for 2025, due in large to uncertainty around global trade tension, and revised higher its near-term inflation forecast, potentially impacting the number of future cuts the policymakers will agree to make going forwards. February data showed services inflation eased to a 10-month low of 3.7%, while wage growth was also slowing. The ECB's wage tracker recorded a decline from 5.4% in November 2024 to 1.3% towards the end of the year. And the labour market is also showing signs of softening. While the Eurozone's unemployment rate remains at a record low of 6.2%, job vacancies are falling in key economies such as Germany and France. A closer look at regional disparities reveals that unemployment in southern Europe remains structurally high at 8%, indicating that those economies are still far from full employment. And surveys also point to declining payroll growth, further limiting domestic inflationary pressures. ECB President Christine Lagarde stopped short of reaffirming that rates were on a downward path and instead said a reduction or a pause were both on the cards. And data released earlier on Friday showed that German industrial orders in January fell by 7% from the previous month, as the previous month's upswing petered out. December orders had risen significantly more than expected on a burst of demand for aircraft, ships, trains, and military vehicles. Wonder whether that was to do with potential tariffs. The parties hoping to form Germany's next government this week agreed to overhaul state borrowing rules to boost defence spending, while also boosting infrastructure investments. The DAX Volatility Index, which measures the implied volatility of the DAX options, was up 2.83% to 22.81, a new six-month high. The euro-US dollar traded 0.7% higher to 1.0834, with the euro climbing to its highest level since November, boosted by the German government's intention to loosen its fiscal rules, a move that is likely to boost growth. The euro has gained about 4% so far this week, its biggest weekly jump since March 2020. The pound US dollar rose 0.5% to 1.2922, climbing to levels last seen in November, as sterling benefited from the dollar weakness. The recent push-up in the pound US dollar has been attributed to two factors. Firstly, on the ongoing trade tensions between the US and its major trade and partners, US President Trump has remarked that a potential trade deal could be worked out between the US and the UK, which has lowered the odds of US trade tariffs being imposed on UK goods. Secondly, it's now widely expected the Bank of England will continue to enact rate cuts ahead. The latest UK services PMI dropped to 51, indicating a slowdown in a key sector. If economic data continues to weaken, it could shake investor confidence. Despite the current optimism of rate cuts, persistently high inflation could force the Bank of England to adopt a more hawkish stance, which could negatively impact equity markets. Now, over in Asia, most Asian stocks fell on Friday, tracking Wall Street's overnight slump as investors' uncertainty deepened over US trade policies after President Donald Trump postponed 25% tariffs on most Mexican and Canadian goods just 2 days after imposing them. Japan's Nikkei 225 plunged 2.1% on Friday, while the TOPIX declined 1.2%. Japan's fourth quarter revised gross domestic product is scheduled to be released on Tuesday. Fourth quarter GDP is likely to be revised downward slightly from 0.7% quarter on quarter, seasonally adjusted to around 0.5% as capital spending comes in weaker than expected, according to ING. The US dollar Japanese yen dropped 0.5% to 148.04, with the Japanese yen hitting its strongest level in 5 months on Friday as increased safe haven demand and speculation over interest rate hikes by the Bank of Japan boosted the currency. The Nikkei volatility, which measures the implied volatility of the Nikkei 225, was up to 28.16. Hong Kong's Hang Seng Index inched 0.2% lower after jumping 3.2% in the previous session, and China's Shanghai Composite edged 0.1% lower, while the Shanghai Shenzhen CSI 300 lost 0.3%. The US dollar Chinese yuan traded 0.3% lower to 7.2349, with the pair down 0.5% over the week. China's National People's Congress will conclude on Tuesday, and February consumer price and producer price inflation data is scheduled for Sunday, March the 9th. China's exports grew at a much slower than expected pace in the January and February period, while imports unexpectedly tumbled, but China's trade balance grew more than expected. Still, the weak exports reflected some headwinds from Trump's trade tariffs, which took effect from early February. Trump increased his China tariffs to 20% this week, and Beijing retaliated with a slew of measures, which also likely factored into weaker import figures. But China's trade surplus did remain strong. City analysts provided insight into the potential effects of China's anticipated steel industry reforms. According to the firm, supply-side reform 2.0 in steel looks very likely and could result in decreased steel production and exports from China. This reduction is seen as a positive for the profit margin of steel producers, both within China and internationally. However, the implications for the iron ore market, which supplies the raw material for steel, are less clear and hinge on steel demand rather than production levels. The analysts estimate that a 50 million ton cut in China's steel production might only reduce global iron ore demand by around 15 million tons, equating to a mere 1% of the global seaborne market. This modest impact suggests that iron ore demand is not as sensitive to changes in steel production as it might seem. Iron ore prices in Singapore were last at $100.7, down from $107 just last week. South Korea's KOSPI was trading 0.4% lower, while India's Nifty 50 edged up 1.93% across this week. The Nifty had dropped for 10 record sessions before rebounding 1.2% on Wednesday. It slumped 6% from a peak in September amid relentless selling by foreign investors. The shift in sentiment for Indian equities has been swift, considering the South Asian nation was a favourite among most emerging market fund managers as recent as September. A rebound in Chinese stocks and a resurgent US dollar has further dimmed the appeal of Indian assets. But even after the sell-off, shares in the India index are still trading at around 20 times earnings, a more expensive proposition in comparison to the MSCI World Index, which trades at around 17 times. India's oversold equity markets could be the turning point for the rest of 2025 on the back of improving fundamentals and stronger macroeconomic stability. Amid market pessimism, analysts at Morgan Stanley noted positive outlook factors, including a CapEx-driven budget, a more accommodative RBI stance, tax reforms boosting foreign inflows, and a strategic trade deal with the US. And analysts also pointed to lower oil prices, a correction in the US dollar index, and improved foreign portfolio investment flows. But in comparison, the Australian share market sank to its lowest level since September after Washington's changing approach to tariffs spooked investors and index bellwether Commonwealth Bank sold off. The S&P ASX 200 dropped 1.8% to 7,948.2 at the market's close, recording its second largest weekly drop this year. 10 sectors were lower, led by technology. Wise Tech declined 3.2% to $88.71, dragging the ASX technology sector lower. Elsewhere, Goodman Group slumped 4.8% to $30.53. That's the lowest price in 11 months. And banks extended a sell-off, with Commonwealth Bank dropping 3.3% to $148.50. Westpac retreated 2.2% to $30.57 after the resignation of retail banking chief Jason Yetton, the third departure of his executive team since September. Consumer staple stocks were a bit of a bright spot as traders switched to the typically more defensive sectors. Woolworth lifted 0.6% to $28.66 and Coles 0.8% to $18.82. The Australian dollar held just above 63 US cents, buoyed by a struggling greenback as fears mounted that the US tariffs could have severe implications for economic growth and fuel inflation. The UK pair slid to 48.80 pence. A bidding war for Insignia Financial is heating up again after private equity house Bain and CC Capital raised their prices for the wealth manager to $5 a share, valuing it at around $3.4 billion. The stock leapt 9.9% to $4.68. Burns treatment company PolyNovo sank 13% to $1.20 after it sought an agreement with chief executive Swami Rote to leave the company following reports of alleged bullying by chairman David Williams. And Spartan Resources slipped 1.4% to $1.42 after it almost doubled losses in the half year to December as royalties increased and the company invested $25 million in exploration. Now, as the AFR reported, there's a simple question racing around the Australian equity market right now. Why isn't anybody buying the dip, particularly in our all-conquering bank stocks? The local index has now lost 6.9% since hitting a record high on February the 14th, even greater than the 6.6% fall that rocked the S&P 500 since its peak on February the 19th. At the heart of the mess is the banking sector, which has been shaken by the sort of volatility investors have not seen in a long time. Commonwealth Bank is down 10.7% from February's record high, and ANZ is 8% off its recent peak, while Westpac and NAB are down 12 and 17% respectively. In part, this is a story of plain old earnings revisions and earnings momentum. As Baron Joe's Jonathan Mott points out, February's trading updates from the big four banks and Bendigo, down 23% in the past month, reveal that net interest margins are under pressure from competition and funding costs. For the first time in 12 months, earnings have been revised downwards. So no one is buying the dip in bank shares because they still look overvalued compared to the earnings growth the market is seeing. But this doesn't tell the whole story. The size of the falls we've seen is extraordinary. NAB and Bendigo fell 8 and 15% on the days they released trading updates. Mott said moves of that magnitude were not seen during the dark days of the GFC. Now, wise old heads of the market suggest this points to some structural issues in the Australian market. The growing influence of superannuation flows on the Australian market, the rise and rise of passive investing, and the fading power of active fund managers. The ability for superannuation funds to buy the dip in bank shares is limited for two reasons. First, they are already up to their eyeballs in banks, having bought $7.4 billion worth of bank stocks in the year to September 2024, taking their ownership of the sector to about 25%. And second, super funds came into this year with the lowest levels of cash since 2019, meaning they don't have the liquidity to buy the dip. Once upon a time, active managers would have been another source of dip buying, but their influence on the market isn't what it once was because of the growth of passive investing, which now accounts for around 22% of the ASX 200 ownership, up from 13% a decade ago. Superfunds love low-cost passive strategies as much as mums and dads. About half of the equity exposure of the $300 million Superfund Australian Retirement Trust is in passive strategies. So the weight of money behind passive has created a virtuous circle as bank stocks have been rising, as more money flows into passive strategies and banks become a bigger part of the index. Passive funds have been buying them, which helps to push their shares up even further, adding to what some investors call an upcrash. But when bank shares start falling and the banks weighting in the index falls, index funds don't stop and consider fundamentals such as valuations and earnings. They just have to keep selling. It's like a classroom, one investor says. Passive funds let you copy the smart kid's homework. But when the smart kid leaves school, you've got a problem. And that's what's happening with passive squeezing out active managers. By the way, the same thing is happening in the US, where the concentration of the market around a handful of tech stocks is now weighing heavily on the index. This is all a reminder that passive momentum can work both ways. And I still got question marks about the valuation of Australian banks. And finally, in crypto, US President Donald Trump wooed the cryptocurrency industry's elite at the White House on Friday, hosting a first-of-its-kind summit focused on his plans for a government-owned stockpile of digital assets. Trump welcomed a wide range of industry players, including Zach Wyckoff, one of the founders of the president's own crypto business, World Liberty Financial. His social media posts showed. And some are questioning about independence and objectivity, of course, because of it. In addition to top administrative officials and lawmakers, guests at the White House's state dinner room included MicroStrategy CEO Michael Saylor, Coinbase co-founder and CEO Brian Armstrong, investors Cameron and Tyler Wicklenoss, and entrepreneur David Bailey. The major focus of the event was Trump's goal to build a strategic reserve containing Bitcoin, which he formalized in his executive order on Thursday, that also said that there will be a stockpile of digital assets. See my post yesterday for this, which I called lipstick on a pig. That order directed the Secretaries of Treasury and Commerce to develop budget-neutral strategies for acquiring additional Bitcoin that have no incremental costs on taxpayers. We don't want any cost on the taxpayers, Trump said at the summit. The reserve will be capitalized with Bitcoin owned by the federal government that's been forfeited as part of criminal civil asset forfeiture proceedings, White House crypto czar David Sacks said in a post on social media platform X. Sacks told reporters at the White House that establishing a Bitcoin reserve should have been done a long time ago. He said taxpayer funds would not be used to acquire digital assets and that there were existing protections in place to safeguard consumers from crypto investments. Those plans disappointed some in the markets who had hoped for a firm plan to buy new tokens. The announcement weighed on the price of Bitcoin. It was last down around 3.5%. This strategic reserve is going to be the biggest point of contention for many of us, said JP Richardson, co-founder and CEO of Exodus, a Bitcoin wallet developer. Although he owns the four coins other than Bitcoin that Trump has suggested including in the reserve, he does not think they have a place in a strategic reserve. Crypto has made big strides, but it's still a relatively nascent industry, Richardson said. Other coins are smaller and function in a very different way. One, he said, may create more risk. Officials invited to the summit praised Trump and executives for clearing the way for the industry's growth. Other executives said it was good to see the administration being collaborative with the industry after years in which some felt they were under attack over security and consumer protection issues. For the first time, industry leaders feel they're walking into a collaborative discussion, says Des Bazzari, co-founder of Wave Digital Assets, a crypto investment advisor who said he did not receive an invitation. Trump was upbeat about the crypto industry's prospects, telling the summit, "We feel like pioneers in a way," he added. "From this day on, America will follow the rule that every Bitcoin knows very well. Never sell your Bitcoin." That's a little phrase that they have. I don't know if it's right or not. Who the hell knows, right? Who knows? Who knows? But so far it's been right. And well, let's keep it that way. Trump's executive order spells out that the government's own Bitcoin holdings should never be sold. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent told the event the US was going to keep the dollar as the world's reserve currency and use stable coins to do that. In a post on X, Brad Garlinghouse, CEO of technology company Ripple, who attended the summit, said he welcomed Trump's recognition that the world of cryptocurrencies stretched beyond Bitcoin. XRP, the coin connected to Ripple, is one of the four other cryptocurrencies Trump has suggested may be added to a crypto reserve. Attendees said that they were optimistic about working with an administration that views crypto as a mainstream asset class and expressed hope for a straightforward regulatory process. So standing back, the question you've got to ask is, have we reached peak uncertainty yet, or is there more to come? I think there probably is, and I do expect markets to continue to be very volatile and continue to slide. And as for the so-called crypto revolution, I'm a bit skeptical of that too, I'm afraid. Anyway, we'll see how it all plays out. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.